Well, welcome to Theology on Tap. My name is Jonathan Lewis.
Hi, everyone. I'm Megan McClenahan.
And we are so happy to have with us tonight Liz Bruning from the Washington Post. Big round of applause for Liz. And without further ado, I'm going to let Megan introduce our fantastic guest tonight.
Awesome. Thanks, Jonathan. I'm so excited to introduce our speaker tonight, Elizabeth Bruning for the Washington Post. Who follows Liz on Twitter? Awesome. One of my favorite facts about Liz is that she is a fellow Texan or grew up in Texas like myself. She graduated from Brandeis with honors in 2013, attended the University of Cambridge as a Marshall Scholar, where she earned her master's in Christian theology. She joined the New Republic in 2015 as a staff writer, and in early 2016, she became editor for the Post Outlook section. And in 2017, she became a columnist, which is probably why you're seeing two or three times as many articles from her if you follow the Post. She has now been commissioning and editing thoughtful stories on big ideas since then, and she lives here in D.C. with her husband, Matt, and her daughter, Jane. And if you followed any of her writings, you know that she comments on religion, faith, culture, and politics, with topics ranging from Star Wars and the Me Too movement to poverty in St. Augustine. So we're really blessed to have Liz here with us tonight to talk about how to live the Catholic counterculture in 2018. So give it up for Elizabeth Bruning.
Hello. Thank you guys for coming out tonight. As Megan said, I switched over to being a columnist recently. That's why I'm tweeting a lot more of my own stuff. Sorry about that. It'll give me the freedom to cause a lot more problems on Twitter than I did as an editor. Or so I hope. So I've tried to keep this talk pretty conversational. I wanted to leave time and space for questions if you have them, because it's a pretty capacious topic, and some slack at the end is already designated in that direction, but just in case. And the hope is to help. So if at any time you need me to clarify or expand on a point, just raise your hand and I'll try to do the best I can. So the idea of the talk was to explain how to live the Catholic counterculture in 2018. And so I arranged it in 10 steps. Hopefully it's kind of funny, but there was an effort. So step one, the first and foremost thing to living the Catholic counterculture is to be Catholic on the inside. The ultimate goal of living Catholic counterculture is not the same as the goal of a typical counterculture movement. The final end is not to make yourself healthier or more beautiful, to raise important points of contradiction against modern society, to attract and join a community of like-minded people with whom you can grow and improve, to save the world or make a new one. These are all laudable goals, and they're all part of it. But the ultimate goal is to change your own will and to educate your desire. Ideally, to will yourself into what God wills for you, and for others, what God wills for them. Not that you can do it by yourself. Pelagianism disclaimer. You can't. Can the Pelagianism fans who clapped for Pelagia see me after? And we'll discuss. Donatists also can accompany them. But the idea is to be what God wills you to be. In other words, the goal of living the Catholic counterculture is to become Catholic on the inside. And it's a long process. I'm certainly not done with it. So you can consider these field notes, little lessons that I've learned while undertaking this long process myself. Number two, learn Catholic history. America is unusual, not only in that we lack the Catholic history of our transatlantic neighbors, but have an actively anti-Catholic history. From whence does anti-Catholicism issue in American history? From all sorts of places. The vagaries of European politics, tenets of classical liberalism, reactions to immigration, and so on and so forth. It's all very historical. The upshot of all this is that learning about the history of the religion, and perhaps more importantly, the history of the people who have lived it through time, isn't the easiest task to accomplish in your average American classroom, unless, of course, you happen to go to a Catholic school and you have an interested tutor. I didn't. I went to all public schools. College, I went to a school that was 60% Jewish and then went to an Anglican grad school. So needless to say, I was on my own a lot. But I read everything I could about Augustine. It's my boy. And much encourage similar readings should you have the time and occasion. The great thing is Catholic history is very long, so you can go back as far as you like or as recent as you want. There's a Catholic for everybody and every interest, but I would encourage you to read about the history of the faith. I would highly recommend it, and there are endless rewards to learning history in general, but in terms of living the Catholic counterculture, learning some Catholic history will help you contextualize and understand the areas of conflict between Catholic culture and the one we live in, which will hopefully give you the tools you need to cope with those conflicts. Furthermore, being a remarkably literate religion, you'll never want for things to read. Number three, Catholic art. There's Catholic art, and then there's learning to appreciate art through a Catholic lens. By this, I mean building up a stable system of aesthetic and moral judgment founded in Christian thought by which you can evaluate the art that reaches you through the mainstream culture, which isn't by any means all bad, and I want to emphasize that. Nothing listed herein should be taken as advice to hide yourself from the world you live in or reject it wholesale. There are infected aspects of modern culture, but I don't see any reason in a total rejection. There are also very wonderful aspects of modern culture. And I would recommend building up a Catholic lens through which to understand and evaluate them. And I would recommend Catholic art. This can mean anything from artwork centering on Catholic subjects to artwork created by Catholics. Some examples of late, the films Novitiate, Silence, and Calvary, the hit television show The Young Pope. Yes, thank you. Very good. And the upcoming miniseries, The Name of the Rose, which is going to come out in 2019. And if you follow me on Twitter, you won't be able to miss it because I'm going to tweet you through the whole book. I remarked on Catholics being especially literate. They are also eagerly artistic. Art helps educate the conscience in ways I can't actually fully explain, not being trained in the arts myself. All I can say is that I have found Catholic films and novels and poetry immensely useful as templates for thinking through my own daily struggles, and I've also found them to be a source of enormous beauty. Augustine has this thought that beauty can heal you somehow, which never gets fully articulated, but it's in there. And I've always liked that impression quite a lot, and I think it's true. And you don't have to like a piece of artwork because it's Catholic. There's bad Catholic art. Yes, friends, there is even Catholic Christian rock. But it's worth sifting through the projects that probably should never have happened to get to the ones that are transcendent and transformative and beautiful that we are blessed to receive. Beauty can change you, and it can heal you, and it's worth seeking out. Number four, Catholic community. Make Catholic friends. Make Catholic enemies. Make Catholic acquaintances. Have Catholic rivals. I am by no means suggesting you refuse to associate with people who aren't Catholic. I think that's a terrible choice for a number of reasons, not least because it's anti-evangelical and counter to the example of Jesus. But what I am suggesting is that you can't get there, wherever you're going, alone. It is not good for man to be alone, says the Lord, and what force on earth is weaker than the feeble strength of one, asks Pete Seeger in my favorite rendition of Solidarity Forever. When you first set out on your journey as a Christian, you will occasionally need friends to help you understand what you ought to do, to pray for you, to support you as you seek God. As you get further along your journey, you will need them virtually all the time. I understand that in heaven you will never be parted with them, so I gather that in perpetuity the arrangement reaches perfection. One of the problems with friendship in contemporary culture is it's thought of as like a first level of romance. So the end of a relationship is being boyfriend and girlfriend, and the bottom level, the starting point, the weakest sense of a relationship is friendship. This is why we have this great phrase, the friend zone, which sounds really fantastic, but actually people mean it in a pejorative sense. I would love to be in all of your friend zones, and I want you to be in my friend zone. And my friend zone is a very full and happy place. And I think that within Catholicism is a fantastic and beautiful tradition of taking friendship very seriously. Friendship is a remarkable and transformative thing. We live in a culture of cynicism. Everything is funny because everyone is willing to suggest secretly it's all dumb and fake. And we also live in a culture of artifice. So most of the time that's true. But friendship is really one of those things that's completely what it's cracked up to be. Have a friend, tell them you love them, drive to the airport and pick them up at 2 a.m, let them come and sleep over periodically unannounced, or whatever it is and however it is you express your love for your friends. But life is too short to pretend you don't really care about them, or that if the relationship went away, you would be okay. And I think that understanding that and getting to a point where I could live that has been one of the biggest developments in my journey as a Catholic, and I wish it the same for all of you. Number five, and I was asked to bring this up, it's on getting married young. Stanley Hauerwas has this theory that you always marry the wrong person. I don't think that can be said exactly, but I do understand the point he's trying to make. You never really know the person you're marrying. People change, and you will change, and circumstances will change you both and elicit behaviors and patterns of thought you hadn't previously seen in one another, no matter how well established your personalities and lives are before you get married. So if you're on the fence about getting married and you're thinking about putting it off because you think you need to get to know your significant other a little bit better before you tie the knot, I would gently submit an alternative view, and that is, bring out your inner Nike and just do it. I got married when I was 23 to a guy I met when I was 16. We dated all the way through high school and through college, and then eventually got married. To be fair, we could have gotten married much sooner. I sort of threatened to do it when I was 18, and my mom had a meltdown. Probably rightfully so. But I am glad that I got married young, if only because it gives me more time with him. And we've both changed so much since I was 23 and he was 25. Now he's knocking on 30 and I'm 27, and we're almost completely different people. Those years for people in our generation are very developmental, right? They're just like the teenage years in terms of making vast leaps ahead. You think about starting high school at 14 and going off to college at 18, you're almost looking at two completely different people. At 14, you still ask your teacher to go to the bathroom. At 18, you live by yourself on college, potentially very well, not always, but you can do it. And in terms of your early 20s, it's much the same way. The people that you're getting to know now, they're not going to be the same people in a few years because the developments you're going through in terms of careers and relationships are so massive. But instead of angsting about it, you just have to accept it. Marriage is a commitment. It's a lot like faith. In fact, in the Old Testament, fidelity tracks very closely with faith and infidelity with idolatry. Marriage is like faith, marital fidelity is like faith, in that you really can't know what you're getting. There just has to be some level of going with it. You throw in your lot with somebody, you hope it turns out well, you do everything you can, but you have to accept there's an element of mystery and adventure to it. And the only thing that's going to keep you in that arrangement as that changes is your belief in the institution itself. So all that being said, marriage is fun stuff. You'll like it. I like it. That all even being said, marriage is not the end-all be-all. It might be the case that you're called to a religious vocation, for example, and that society's assumption that marriage and kids are the natural endpoint of a life well-lived is working against you and your discernment. In that case, all I can suggest from my vantage point is prayer and a good long conversation with one of DC's many talented priests or nuns or monks. But I think that, you know, in a modern world, all the movies end with so-and-so and so-and-so getting married, right? I mean, if there's a coming-of-age show or series, it kind of ends in a marriage word thrust. And so it can feel like that's, you know, capstone development, right? That's eventually where you're going to get. Not necessarily. Maybe you're going to go live on a mountain somewhere and be in a monastery. That would be extremely cool. And I suggest that those vocations, which, you know, in the Middle Ages and prior seemed very open and available to people, sometimes seem much rarer. But if that's a calling you feel invested in, I encourage you to consider it. The next one is similarly weird and personal. Six, on having kids young, was also asked to bring it up. I got married when I was 23. I got pregnant when I was 24. I had been married a year. No matter how shocking that is to you, it was much more shocking to my mom. She was very uplifting with helpful comments like, "You're about to have to grow up real fast, Missy." She was also completely right. What can I say now about having a child young? The strange thing about having a child is that once you have one, you no longer have an abstract child, as you did throughout your pre-kid life and your pregnancy. You now have, or I should say, I now have, a person named Jane. She's just an individual. There's no way to explain before you have a child what it's going to be like having a new person in your life. It's easy to think of kids as like a series of things you have to do or obligations you have to meet. But once you have them, they're an individual. They're a lot like you, and they're a lot like your significant other, like your spouse. And to me, that was really surprising. I hadn't thought about that. I'd thought about all the difficulties of being a mother, the things I would have to do, and the challenges and the regimens, but I had never realized there would be a person here that I would be negotiating all of this with. And even though it's clearly the job of the parents to support the kids, once you have them, it doesn't exactly feel like someone's working against you at cross purposes. They're working with you. They like you even sometimes. And that's a very precious thing. The other thing I couldn't have predicted about my daughter before I had her is what an immense source of joy she would be in my life. I'm happier than I've ever been. I wouldn't trade it back for anything. It was surprising, perhaps to all involved, myself and my husband, not least, but wonderful. It's excellent. It's sublime. It's the most serious, most real thing I've ever done. Nothing else really matters. Everything else takes on the shade of a little bit ridiculous when you have a child, in part because your life becomes a little bit ridiculous. You go to work with meatloaf on you. I was late tonight because the kid didn't want to eat. It's like, I'm hungry. I'm like, all right, I'll make you dinner. And she's like, actually, now I want to sit on the tray of my high chair. That's what I want to do. I don't want to eat anymore. Okay, well, that's not going to happen. So we're going to have to negotiate some third way here, which concluded with her eating a lot of meatloaf and then clocking me down. She knew I was leaving because I had taken my coat out. And so now her dad's probably feeding her a lot of popsicles. It's one of those things. But tonight, my husband and I go to bed. It'll be with our daughter between us. And you've never had a better teddy bear than a toddler. And none of these things make it any easier to have a child when you want to in our current system. And I know that. It's hard for women to advocate for themselves at work, and it's an area where American policy hasn't remotely caught up with the good and right. I understand why people put it off, and I think that pushing for policies that will allow people to build families when they choose instead of when their boss think it sounds right is key to making life in this country a lot more humane. So that's one of my large interests, is advocating for more humane maternity leave policies, healthcare, and so on and so forth. I completely understand why it's difficult, and I don't think it's fair, but supposing you have the means and are in the position and are on the fence, yeah, go for it. It's lots of fun. You'll love it. It's great. Number 7, on working in the world. Unless you find your way into a particular vocation or are employed by an especially gracious employer, and perhaps even then, you're going to make compromises in the world. Many of those things will come through the vector of work. The key is understanding which compromises are unavoidable and or worthwhile and which are worth taking a stand over. Whatever the case, all of these situations can be helped by having good, durable relationships with the people you work with and the people you choose to associate with outside of work. Herein, I can only counsel what Christ himself did. Be loving and forgiving and tell the truth. Try to have a little bit of a sense of humor about things. You're watching me try to have a little bit of a sense of humor about things, so I understand that may sound like a daunting task. But it helps. One of the greatest things about Christianity, MIHO, is that it's a relationship that counsels a great deal of interpersonal love. And you can dispense it at your own risk. Sometimes it will be painful. People will not reciprocate. But at work is one of those strange opportunities for a kind of evangelism that's very beautiful and very moving, and that is just being dependably kind and gracious with people, generous in your interpretation of their deeds and meanings, and reliable when they need you. And I found that makes a lot of difference. It doesn't make enough of a difference to wheedle maternity leave out of someone, for instance, if that's what you need, 4 months paid off at a time. But it does make a difference in the small negotiations you have to make when it comes to religious holidays and so on and so forth. 8, on hard times and on joy. It might be the case that suffering helps you see God, but it's also the case that plenty of people in our generation and before have lost their faith altogether in times of suffering. Cognizant of this, I think it's important to prepare yourself for the hard times that will come. Some will be related to your faith. I've had a couple of those, and some will not be. But you'll need a quiet heart to hear God when the din of the outside world is at its loudest and most cacophonous. To that end, I would recommend reading, amongst other things, Augustine's Confessions for the kinds of suffering that are long and drawn out and indeterminate, and Cardinal Sarah's The Power of Silence Against the Dictatorship of Noise for sufferings that are short and immediate. Both will arm you against the periods of time that you will feel most alone by helping you anchor yourself not to the world but to God, which is the point of all of this anyway. Another small tip, unrelated to faith. When the going gets tough, turn off social media. Not going to help. Can only make things worse. Log off, fam. Number 9, on discernment of your role. There's an inescapable note of living out loud to this whole conversation that we're engaged in, but I don't mean to suggest that everyone who wants to be living the Catholic counterculture in 2018 needs to, say, become a newspaper columnist and write enthusiastically about Augustine in a mainstream publication for readers who sort of can't figure out what the deal is. Indeed, that is what one might call a niche occupation. Evangelizing isn't the main focus of every life. Not every person is cut out for it, and it's no small thing to evangelize strictly by leading a good example. There's no one profession, no one life to live in the Catholic counterculture. The important thing is to live the life you lead in a way that pleases God. Do what you will and do it with love, as Augustine says. That will require discernment of your role, which is an understanding of what God intends for you in your life. I don't think it's a strictly inward process. You'll need other people to help you, and spiritual direction is important. Fortunately, DC has no shortage of excellent spiritual directors. And number 10, on how easy it all is. By now, this is perhaps all sounding kind of difficult, kind of bizarre. Get really into dusty old history books, watch Silence with your new Catholic friends, marry a random stranger, become a teen mom, tell your boss to broker a sweet leave package with you, or you're tweeting that your employer hates families. Maybe become a monk on a mountaintop, who knows? But it's easier than all that. For one, Silence is a good movie. Your friends just need to settle down and give it a watch. For another thing, all the Protestant accusations made against Catholicism to the tune of Catholicism is a worldly religion over the centuries have a point. Catholicism has a way of meeting you exactly where you are. It's a religion for human beings. It's a religion for your senses. There's art and beauty. There are things that you can interpret the way you are. You do not need to be superhuman nor morally heroic to get along on your way to God. He wouldn't do that to you, and the church would be at a loss if he had. On the contrary, it's fairly easy to live the Catholic counterculture, all things considered. It just means to be human, fully human, to seek God, to pursue beauty and truth, to love and be loved. The rest is just details. Thank you, guys. So we have time for a Q&A. Yes.
Well, thank you very much for speaking, and very interesting points. But my main point, just to my question, is to get to what you said at the start about being a good Catholic on the inside. But isn't that putting our life under a bushel basket? I mean, Catholicism is going to be that stumbling block to the Jews and foolishness to the Gentiles. Because we have to be Catholics in the world. That sign of contradiction. So how do we keep Catholics on the inside without violating the great condition that was never abdicated?
So how can we be Catholic on the inside without violating the Great Commission, never abdicate your role in society? How to be Catholic on the inside without putting your light under a bushel? I think of it as a phases thing. You have to be Catholic on the inside before you can be properly Catholic on the outside. There's some level of faking it until you make it that actually works. And that's like when you're trying to figure out what to do at Mass by watching a really old lady. And that will help you figure out what to do. But it's actually worth reading about the liturgy, because that will form you inside and you get more out of it and you practice it better when you're formed within as well as without. So I would think of them as not mutually exclusive, but a situation where one leads to a betterment of the other, if that makes sense. Think. Anybody else? Yes?
How do you know when you're in a counterculture versus in the Catholic bubble?
How do you know when you're in living a Catholic counterculture versus living inside the Catholic bubble? The answer is, like, sort of shortly, people be getting mad. when you're living Catholic counterculture, you know, periodically you're going to seem strange. I came into work one day at my old job. My boss is like, "You have something on your forehead." I'm like, "It's Ash Wednesday, fam." It's like, "What is that?" I'm like, "What do you think it is? Ash is Ash Wednesday. It's not Dirty Wednesday." and you're going to run into situations like those, and you're going to run into situations that are a lot more contentious that have to do with your position on life. For example, that's one that I get into a lot of confrontations over. And that's usually a pretty good sign that you're living in a countercultural way. The other way is you sort of recognize the world isn't made to fit you in a certain way. Sort of like everywhere I go, I feel like things are really high up because I'm abnormally small. But the world isn't made to fit someone who's 24 and has a kid, basically. There are all kinds of places where you can see that you can't afford the childcare, and employers don't expect you to have it, and your friends are kind of weirded out by it. And it can be really difficult to arrange your life around those places where it doesn't really suit someone who's living in the way you're living. And that's how you know you're living in a countercultural way. The Catholic bubble, I have to actually speak highly of it. People are very mad inside the Catholic bubble too, don't get me wrong. Mad about completely different things. Generally, you can't just gauge where you are by the level of anger. Maybe the subject of anger. But, you know, I think of the Catholic bubble as a mothership. It's good to spend time in Catholic community and to build and fortify yourself and to learn and improve and grow in that way. And then you venture out in the world and preach the gospel to every living thing. Yeah, that's how I would think about that. Yes?
In light of what you said, do you have particular advice to those who are pursuing a vocation to either in political life or working for the state?
Yeah, for someone who's pursuing political life or working for the state, you know, I think it's great in that capacity to get a good sense of Catholic social teaching, and also outside of the sort of social encyclicals, to get a bigger grip on the whole history of Catholic political thought. I would read Augustine, City of God, and so on and so forth, but the idea is to try to fortify your conscience. What's going to be most compromised in that situation is your conscience. You're going to be told by other people who have a lot of power, who you respect, to doubt it. And you can certainly be convinced to do that. Anybody could be. And so the only way to get around it is to just kind of fortify your conscience, build it up, make sure it's very, very much rightly calibrated, and do the best that you can. I don't think it's impossible to do good in governance. I think that it's very possible to do good, but it's going to be a situation where you don't find yourself a perfect fit with either side of the American political spectrum, so there's going to be challenges. Yeah?
Are you surprised by working in a workplace that sometimes can be hostile?
How do you survive working in a workplace that can be hostile to your Christian faith? That's a very good question. The thing that I have tried to keep in mind is to love your enemies. You know, sometimes people have genuinely been grieved by either Christians that they have known or a Christian culture that they've been a part of. People have very painful pasts with the faith, and I try to keep that in mind. As talkative as I am about it, that some people are receiving it in a way that I don't mean it. They're receiving it as kind of hostile and a little bit painful. And so I try to be very, very cognizant of that possibility. But some people also just don't like Christianity and don't like Christians. They're just resolutely secular, for instance. They think that Christianity is a cancer on society, et cetera, et cetera. You can argue with them. Certainly work isn't always the most conducive to that. You want to go to a forum for the good stuff. My tendency would be to keep in mind that it is our role to love our enemies. And it's an opportunity to sort of evangelize by example. If someone doesn't like you because of your faith, they know that. They're aware of how they feel about you. And one of the ways to de-escalate and disarm in a situation like that is to like them anyway, or to do your best to understand them anyway, or to try to make light of things with them anyway. And that is something that I have made an effort to do my best at over time. I'll talk to anybody anytime, pretty much, whatever they believe, whoever they are, wherever they come from, however bizarre, outlandish, or offensive I find the beliefs, I'll talk to them. I'll at least have a discussion with them and hear them out. Not because I expect my beliefs to change. I don't. I think they're very stable. But because I want to provide them with a recognition of their dignity and to have an exchange that makes them feel seen and understood. And, of course, you can't fake seen and understood. You just have to do it. And so that would be my recommendation. And there's like a tertiary level here where someone's taking it to a real extreme. You just got to call out the EEOC. I mean, you know your rights. So I wouldn't discourage that either if the situation called for it. You know, we're living in a period where there are lots of cases like that that are very contentious that people are pushing right now. So always preferable to keep things out of court if you can with your coworkers, and probably loving your enemy and thinking in that mindset is the best way to do that. Anybody else? Yes.
How do you live the counterculture without seeming holier than thou? I feel like a lot of people hear you go to church on Sunday and they start analyzing everything in your life. Anxiety about even doing it.
Yeah, so the question is, how do you live the Catholic counterculture without seeming holier than thou? I think that's a very good question. People will kind of analyze everything in your life when they figure out that your faith is important to you. I see you swear, indeed, with some frequency. People have certain opinions about what it is to be pious that are usually based on kind of American Protestant Christianity. They're like, I hear you're Catholic, but you drink. I'm like, but? Therefore. and so that can feel hostile, be uncomfortable when people see you that way and are trying to fit you into that box. And I think that the only way to get around it is just to be as honest and straightforward with people as you possibly can if it comes naturally to your personality. There's nothing really wrong with being a nicely pious person. Everyone has that one really pious friend that they're like, I don't cuss in front of him. And I think that's a good thing. I'm totally unbothered by personality types like that. In fact, I find them pretty inspirational. But I understand not wanting to be seen that way. And I guess just a certain level of transparency and honesty is the only way you can get through that. But of course, some people are completely private and don't want to live that way. And you see my bicameral mind is on display as I argue with myself. But, you know, if you're someone who's not as disposed to total transparency with others, but you want them to realize that you're a fully fleshed out person and not a character, a cartoon character, I think the only way to try to do that is just to build a relationship and let it be revealed over time. You know, don't give up on them if they don't give up on you. Even if they do give up on you, try not to give up on them. That's my best advice. A lot of people, sort of like in sort of secular mainstream culture that I have met, who aren't religious and are maybe a little bit skeptical, like knowing a really religious person, because everybody has moments where they either have a curiosity about religion or moments where they're suffering and they want to know what a religious person would say. And there are a lot of people that I am in that position for when they have a question about forgiveness or something like that that's very much native to Christianity. They'll consult me on it. And I really am honored by that role. So that's a good outcome, I think. Yes? Yes.
Going off this question, what do you think is the single greatest thing we can do to uphold the counterculture?
What is the single greatest thing we can do to uphold the counterculture? So the thing that I do is to refuse to speak in a way that makes it sound like I possibly think that I'm wrong about God. So instead of using kind of constructs like, well, I believe, just sort of cut that off and be like, you know, well, I believe it's wrong to do a murder. Really. It's wrong to do a murder. And have moral certitude in the things that we can be morally certain about that are part of the teachings of the church. I think that that makes an impression on people because so much of how we talk in society is structured around, well, I feel like, or I think that, and I understand it's not a badly intended way of speaking. You're giving the other person space to sort of have a counter belief that isn't going to cause a conflict because you're both entitled to those private spheres of belief that you have. But the whole private sphere of personal belief that can't be challenged or penetrated by outside analysis or argument is just not part of the faith. And it's not hostile. I don't think too hostile to just posit what we know to be true. Not what you believe to be true, what you know to be true. This is the truth. You're dealing with the truth. And that can certainly make you sound kind of weird. Make it seem like you forgot some words. But I think that that is one of the single best things you can do, in part because it gives other people who also believe but are shy or are growing space to be outwardly Catholic, outward religiously, you know, as well. And it also gives people the right impression of who we are, a religion that's about the truth. Right? There's this great line from Tolstoy where he says that Christianity was this religion that you weren't supposed to follow because it was going to make you rich or because it was going to make you a god or because it was going to bring you great honor, but simply because it was true. That's in the kingdom of God is within you. And that stuck with me. And the truth value of it is what it eventually I was kernel at all these debates. And so that's the part that I try to champion if I have to pick one thing. Yes.
It's funny that you say that, because the people I find that I argue with most, and maybe because on a basis level I realize that we agree with some things, are Catholics.
Yeah, so the argument is like, how do you engage with Catholics when you have vast disagreements? You agree on the truth, but you disagree on application or prudence. So my first advice would be, if possible, always argue in private. It's very, very contrary to the way that the world is set up now in terms of social media. Social media very much rewards public arguments. If someone calls you out, you obviously feel inclined to respond in public because you're trying to defend yourself and your honor and reputation. But, you know, it's in James. If someone is causing conflict, causing a problem with you, you have a big disagreement and you know it, the best thing to do is at least try to settle it between yourselves privately first. I don't like having big arguments with other Catholics, for example, on Twitter. There are several other sort of major Catholic writers who I have private relationships with offline, some of them perhaps writing for the New York Times. Who there are vast disagreements there. I mean, there are big disagreements, but we've resolved that it wouldn't be good for either of us to litigate them in public. And I think that on the completely private scale of friend to friend, it works in the same way. So, you know, kind of resist the impulse to recruit other people. Try to settle it privately and be open with them that that's what you're doing. Hey, I want to settle this between us because I want us to have a relationship that's good, or because I don't want to cause scandal. I don't want to cause fractures in our community. I want to understand where you're coming from. That would be how I would prefer to litigate that. Another option is to get a Slack going and just have a big fight in there, which is a great way to pass the time at work. if you have some off hours, bring up SSPX and just see where it goes. That's the best I can do for that one. But I also think conflict is going to irrevocable part of life, and also that Catholic arguments oftentimes are pretty illuminating and pretty good, and I've quite liked the ones that I've had in terms of structured debates I've gone and done. Found very illuminating, so that's also part of it. Yeah. What did I study? So Brandeis is kind of funky. There wasn't a religion major. That was already what I was into. So I majored in English and sociology, double majored, and I studied religion inside both of them. So when I was getting an English degree, most of my professors were doing independent studies with me and letting me read Augustine. And my sociology degree was graduate course on the sociology of religion, sort of how people believe, why they believe, what constitutes belief, interesting stuff like that. My minor is in Near Eastern and Judaic studies because that came closest to late antiquity, North Africa. I was pretty single-mindedly Augustine in college. I got into Augustine, and I was like, wow, how is everyone not studying this guy full-time all the time? And it's like, the answer is, yeah, they were in like 1100. sort of missed my moment there. But the great thing about getting into studying a theologian like Augustine is he had such a huge mind that he was interested in everything. So after a while, you also wind up sort of similarly interested in everything. People who get really into Aquinas end up the same way, where like they have this great body of knowledge of Aquinas, and they're also like really knowledgeable about politics and history and philosophy and so on, because they're slowly working their way through all of his questions and answers. Read a lot of books, read widely. Thank you very much for saying it was a good talk. I worried it would be really bad. I showed it to my husband, and he was like, what is the 10 steps to? What is the final 10 steps of this and you go to heaven? I was like, no, that's completely wrong. And I worried that it would come off like a recovery program. so I'm glad that it didn't. Thank you very much. Anybody, any other questions? Yeah, one more question. Yes.
In your latest column, you spoke about the Me Too movement. I'm wondering what you would say how the Catholic Church can form the Me Too movement or aid in it.
So in my latest column, I wrote about the Me Too movement. How can the Catholic Church aid in the Me Too movement or inform it? I think the Catholic Church is still suffering from a real crisis of moral authority from the sexual abuse crisis. I think a lot of Catholics and a lot of folks in the broader public feel like that has never been properly addressed or resolved. And maybe it's something that just has to be done over a long period of repentance. But I think that the Catholic Church can, you know, sort of participate in this movement by lifting up the voices of survivors, taking them seriously in terms of coming up with reforms, instituting them. There are a lot of great Catholic feminist writers who write about sexual assault, and I think it's pretty universally agreed it's a problem. The answer is, what's the solution? I was trying to, you know, lodge a sort of Catholic critique of Hobbes, of all things, in that column. And I think that entering into the conversation with some of the knowledge that Catholics have about ethics and virtue, you know, you don't even necessarily have to brand it in that way. Christine Imba is another great writer at The Post who, she's getting snaps here, well-deserved and wonderful snaps. But she wrote a piece where she was like, everyone's saying that this consent movement is going to make people have less sex. That is good. And that was a very fascinating and interesting piece that a lot of people hadn't thought about. So, you know, in terms of on the ground at your local parish, you know, being a part of, you know, if you can support people who are going through stuff, if you can convince your pastors to very carefully and seriously attend to the spiritual needs of people who have suffered violence and abuse, I think that's very important. And then on the whole church administrative level, taking the stories and experiences of survivors very seriously as we institute reforms and seriously enforcing them is very important. And then on the individual level, you know, listening, being a listening ear, and sometimes all you can do is suffer with someone. And there's something very Catholic about that, I think. Thank you very much for asking. That was our last question. Thank you guys so much for coming out. I really appreciate it.
Thank you very much, Liz. I think we can all say what a wonderful talk this evening. If you have other questions, I saw a few more hands up. You can come up and try to grab Liz for a second offline. And let's just close in a prayer of gratitude for Liz's talk, for her family, and for each of us that we might live this counterculture in 2018. So if you join me together in the name of the Father, and of the Son, and of the Holy Spirit, amen. God, in this new year, we just pray that you may bless each of us in a special way, that we may live as seeds sowing in this world. You may bless our workplaces, our homes and apartments, our family members near and far, and all of our friendships. Help us to make each of those people better and to draw them closer to you in this new year. And we ask this through Christ our Lord. Amen.